It is Monday, April 14th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Reserve tickets are now available for the 64th Annual Opera in the Ozarks, June 20th through July 18th. This season offers 22 shows and a gala concert with performances at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs and Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Tickets and information available at opera.org. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Later on this edition of Ozarks, a Pea Ridge family works to bring a family member home. A new trail lets walkers, runners, and cyclists see a part of Northwest Arkansas that's pretty much been a secret. And the lowdown on voodoo from a guest speaker who visited the University of Arkansas campus late last week. First, the state of Arkansas is appealing a federal court decision blocking the state's ban on most abortions after 12 weeks of pregnancy. The Arkansas Attorney General's office Friday filed a notice of appeal to uphold the Human Heartbeat Protection Act passed by the state legislature last year. The law had been blocked from going into effect by federal judge Susan Wright, and last month she struck down most provisions of the act. State Senator Jason Rapert spoke Friday at the Capitol with other Republican legislators applauding the decision to appeal.
The Roe v. Wade decision was an error. In the history of our great nation, people have at times hid behind a flawed interpretation of the U.S. Constitution to protect all sorts of depravity and repression. When people have told me many times that this is unconstitutional, they forget that the Constitution was once used to prohibit women having the right to vote. The Constitution was once used to say that black-skinned persons, that African Americans, were not full persons in our nation. This was wrong.
Senator Rapert says asking courts to continually reassess rulings protecting abortion is critical for those wanting to ban the procedure. Meanwhile, Rita Sklar, the director of the ACLU of Arkansas, says she finds fault with Senator Rapert's court strategy.
He's going in the wrong direction. We're talking about expansion of rights. And we are not going to see a diminution of rights, of women's rights to maintain autonomy over their own personal, private medical decisions.
Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, concerned about future legal costs, says he proceeded with the appeal only after getting assurances from legislative leaders that the legal proceedings would not have an impact on the budget of the Arkansas State Medical Board, which is the defendant in the lawsuit. Arkansas Surgeon General Joe Thompson says the nationwide public release of Medicare claims data last week is heralding a future of greater transparency on how health care is delivered and assessed. The information on claims costs had been withheld for decades until a federal judge overturned an injunction on the release of the information. Thompson argues new public numbers, which are only available for the year 2012, comprise just one part of many aspects of health care.
And there are methods to actually measure and assess each of those, not only what it costs, but also the quality, the effectiveness, and patient experiences. And I think we're going to have a growing demand by consumers as well as those who are paying for health care to have more transparency in the system. And I would anticipate far more information over the next 10 years becoming available than has been available over the last several decades.
Thompson says Medicare's recent disclosure of billing data may also signal a step toward embracing a move away from the fee-for-service model of billing toward an approach that bills for episodes of care. The state has been working with health care providers and payers in recent months toward implementing an episodic billing structure through its Payment Improvement Initiative. Beginning today in Fayetteville, city crews will be planting trees along the sidewalk and median of Highway 71B between Rock and Maple Streets. The city says the work will take place, depending on the weather, between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. through Friday. While the trees are being planted, temporary lane closures will be required. The Razorback baseball team dropped 2 of 3 games during a weekend road series against LSU. The weekend on the road leaves Arkansas with a 7-8 record in the SEC. They're 22-15 overall. Play continues tomorrow evening when the Hogs host Stephen F. Austin for the first of 9 straight games at Baum Stadium. And the Northwest Arkansas Naturals had a rough weekend as well. The Nats lost to the Frisco Rough Riders Friday and Saturday night, then dropped an 11-6 decision to Midland yesterday. The series against Midland continues tonight in cold weather at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Cloudy tonight, gradually clearing. Overnight lows in the mid-20s in northwest Arkansas, dropping to 30 in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunshine tomorrow. Highs will be from the mid-50s to near 60. Tomorrow night, clear. A little bit warmer. Still, though, lows tomorrow night from 32 to 37. This is Ozarks at Large. An undocumented Mexican college student is being detained in a San Diego jail for illegally crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S. The case is drawing attention here in Arkansas because Marisol Soto is from Pea Ridge. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
The Soto family has lived in Pea Ridge, Arkansas for 13 years after crossing the border from Mexico City into California in 2001. They're undocumented. Parents Andrea and Martin Soto work full-time to raise two daughters, Marisol, who's 20, and Mariana, who's 14. Seated next to her parents, who don't speak English, Mariana said her sister Marisol graduated from Pea Ridge High School in 2011 with big plans.
She wanted to go to college, but that year, September 18th, she ended up going to Mexico because she wasn't able to go to college here.
And why not?
Because she didn't have a Social Security number.
With assistance from the Mexican consulate in Little Rock, Marisol Soto secured a passport and left the United States in the autumn of 2011 to return to Mexico City to pursue her education. Her plan was to secure her nursing degree at a Red Cross military school and work in Mexico City with the hope that comprehensive immigration reform would someday create a pathway for her to return to her family in the United States. But her status as an American immigrant drew negative attention from students, teachers, and neighbors, her sister said.
She was bullied because down there they have a picture that if you're from the United States, you're rich and you have everything, and that you think you're too higher than everybody else.
Mariana said the situation escalated to the point that her sister's life was at risk.
In two occasions, she almost got raped down there.
Marisol wanted to come back to Arkansas, and she'd heard that a group called the National Immigrant Youth Alliance could help her safely cross the border back into the United States to seek asylum. The National Immigrant Youth Alliance stages political protests at U.S. congressional offices, U.S. border crossings, and detention centers to raise awareness about prosecutorial discretion. In 2011, the Obama administration issued an executive order directing immigration customs enforcement officials to pursue prosecutorial discretion in deporting only those that pose a criminal threat and not individuals with lawful status. For example, undocumented immigrants gainfully employed and enrolled in school. In the end, Marisol Soto, along with 100 others, were recruited by the National Immigrant Youth Alliance to participate in a Bring Them Home campaign March 10th, turning themselves into U.S. border security, requesting asylum. This is Marisol's mother, Andrea, talking, translated by Mariana.
Her life in Mexico was threatened many times, and without a place to live or a home, she decided to risk herself and just join the organization without knowing that much.
Marisol has been held in a San Diego detention center for over a month. Again, Mrs. Soto.
It's difficult because they have past immigrants there from a long time ago still detained there, and they have them all mixed up and with criminals that have done worse things, and she's mixed up with people that she shouldn't be with.
Marisol's father, Martin, says jail is no place for his daughter.
No, Marisol es una niña muy buena, muy buena gente.
She's a good girl. She doesn't get in trouble. She's very steady, full.
Marisol Soto's high school friend also came forward to support her. She said the last time she spoke with her was the day she left across the border back into the U.S.
My name is Ashley Bollinger, and I'm 20. And we met through going to school with each other. They moved down our road. She told me that she was leaving and that she wouldn't have any signal. She wouldn't be able to talk to me, that it would be a while before we would be able to talk, and that I told her to be safe.
Ashley's parents are also supportive of the Soto family.
Eddie Bollinger, Pea Ridge, Arkansas. The Soto family is among the best friends and neighbors I have ever known. Marisol is like my third daughter, and she calls me her second dad.
The Arkansas United Community Coalition, an immigrants' rights group based in Fayetteville, has also been assisting the family in trying to bring Marisol Soto home. And they've posted a petition on Facebook. The family hopes to obtain 1,000 signatures and are over halfway towards that goal. But late last week, an immigration court ruled against Marisol's asylum petition. The Soto family has sought direct intervention in the form of congressional letters from both Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor and John Bozeman. They've refused to help. Next, Marisol will go before an immigration judge, her sister Mariana says.
On April 15th at 1 p.m., she's going to go in front of a judge, and that judge is going to decide if she either stays here or not. And if she doesn't, he's going to automatically deport her right away.
Hispanics account for about three-quarters of an estimated 11.7 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S., and those who leave the United States and attempt to reenter are committing a federal crime. According to the Pew Research Hispanic Trends Project, the United States has seen a dramatic increase in such cases, reaching nearly 80,000 due to stricter U.S. Border Patrol enforcement procedures. As for Northwest Arkansas nursing student Marisol Soto, what happens if she's deported? Mrs. Andrea Soto, her mom, translated by her 14-year-old daughter, Mariana.
No tiene a dónde llegar. No sabemos qué va a pasar o qué va a hacer si la deportan.
She doesn't have a place to go, so we don't know where she'd go or what we'd do if she got deported.
Still, Mariana Soto plans to carry on. This gifted 14-year-old girl is starting early by enrolling this summer in Northwest Arkansas Community College's nursing program. She's also planning to obtain her DACA credentials. Those are Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals, Identification Card, a Work Authorization Card, and Legal Driver's License. It's a federal program that provides young undocumented people in good standing brought illegally into the United States by their parents, the means to pursue a life out of the shadows. And had her sister Marisol stayed in Arkansas, she likely would have been awarded her DACA credentials as well and currently would be enrolled in nursing school. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like more information, you can go to change.org. And in about 8 minutes on Ozarks, shedding some light on voodoo.
You know, we think of what religions are, that we practice religions, and that we have, that religions have these boundaries. And in reality, people who practice voodoo in Haiti, for example, are very, very devout Catholics. Most of them go to church.
That conversation ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Jeff Bowman lost both his legs in the Boston Marathon bombings, but he found a new life.
I'm just glad I'm still here. There was, you know, a window of 2 minutes of where I'm not sitting here with you right now.
We'll talk with him next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Tune in this afternoon from 1 to 3 to 91.3 FM.
Last week, a new poll indicated some of the most important races in Arkansas's 2014 election are incredibly close. Also in the past 7 days, a Walmart announcement regarding India and more. Roby Brock with Talk Business Arkansas has this recap of the past week in business and politics.
New polling from Talk Business and Hendricks College shows Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mike Ross in a virtual dead heat with potential GOP rival Asa Hutchinson. Democratic Senator Mark Pryor has a narrow lead over his Republican challenger, Congressman Tom Cotton. The survey of more than 1,000 likely statewide voters has a margin of error of 3%. Ross leads Hutchinson 44-43%, while Pryor nudged Cotton 45.5-42.5%. Two potential issues that may be on the November ballot offer contrasting attitudes from Arkansas voters. The latest poll that we just indicated shows that an overwhelming majority of Arkansans are in favor of raising the state's minimum wage to $8.50 per hour. Voters are evenly split on a possible medical marijuana proposal. The minimum wage proposal would pass 79-17% if it were on the ballot today. The medical marijuana proposal is evenly divided at 45% for, 45.5% against. Colette Honorable, chair of the Arkansas Public Service Commission, testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy on Thursday. Honorable discussed threats to the reliability of the nation's electric grid as it pertains to natural disasters and potential terrorist threats. After breaking off its partnership with Bartai Enterprises last year, Walmart now says it will open 50 new wholesale outlet centers in India in the next 5 years. The Bentonville-based global retailer also said it would launch online operations aimed at developing more business with small traders in India. A company that would make dolls and a patent-approved eye drop medical company won the top spots in the annual Donald W. Reynolds Governor's Cup Collegiate Business Plan competition on Wednesday. Arlisa, a business plan promoted by students from John Brown University, won first place in the undergraduate category. LumaDrop, spearheaded by University of Arkansas students, won first place in the graduate category. Both plans were awarded $25,000 each for their first place finish. Camphill Air Pollution Control has expanded its corporate headquarters in Jonesboro with the recent opening of a 13,000-square-foot office facility for sales and administration. Camphill is a global manufacturer of dust collection equipment and air filters. Construction of the new office buildings also freed up additional production space in its Jonesboro manufacturing plant. The firm employs 85 at its corporate headquarters in Northeast Arkansas. Finally, a report of the number of charges filed by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on the basis of harassment and discrimination showed that the state of Arkansas's numbers dropped more than 35% from 2012 to 2013. That's the most of any state in the nation. The total number of Arkansas charges filed in 2012 were 2,374, while the state only had 1,524 charges filed last year, according to the report. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas and Ozarks at Large is provided in part by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. I would also like to remind you that the KUAF website is offering passes to the Fayetteville Roots Festival August 28th through the 31st. One winner will receive two sold-out VIP passes, which includes the Friends of the Festival backstage concert, late-night concerts, and the main stage. The winner will be announced August 18th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration available at KUAF.com. University of Arkansas professor and author Moja Koff will deliver a presentation Wednesday on the campus of Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville. It's about women in the Syrian Revolution. The event is part of NWAC's theme semester-long focus on Syria and will be Wednesday from noon until 1:15 p.m. in room 108 of the Becky Panight Student Center on the NWAC campus in Bentonville. The program is free and open to the public. The presentation is titled Syrian Women's Nonviolence Activism in the Revolution. Dr. Koff is an associate professor at the University of Arkansas, where she's in her 19th year of teaching comparative literature and Middle East studies. She's author of the novel The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf, as well as other books. Forget the mid-20s forecast for tonight. It is spring. And to help reassure us, the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks will hold their annual plant sale Friday, April 25th. From 5 until 8 for garden members, and then again Saturday the 26th from 8 a.m. until 2 p.m. for the general public. The sale is free both days, but you'll need to bring cash or checks to purchase merchandise from area vendors. Vendors and local plant societies are expected to be selling vegetables, herbs, trees, perennials, and hanging baskets. For more information, bgozarks.org. The park at West End in Fort Smith opened this weekend and will continue to have Ferris wheel rides through the warm months on Fridays from 4 until 9 p.m. and Saturdays from 10 until 9 p.m. through late May. Summer hours for the park, located at the western edge of Garrison Avenue in downtown Fort Smith, begin May 27th and will include expanded hours Tuesday through Saturday. You can learn much more by calling the park at West End at 784-2368. Bentonville is becoming a hotspot for the comings and goings of extinct animals. Recently, the Museum of Native American History installed the fossil of a mammoth in its lobby, purchased from a firm in Arizona. Now, Rexy the T-Rex will be leaving the Bentonville Library. Rexy has been in the library's main hall for the past half dozen years, but Rexy's taking a new post with the Arkansas Discovery Network as part of a traveling dinosaur exhibit. Rexy is a half-size replica of the bone-chasing T-Rex that was featured in the 20th Century Fox movie Night at the Museum. Previously, Rexy was on tour to promote the DVD release of the Night of the Museum DVD, traveling from New York to Los Angeles. Upon completion of that tour, Rexy got a makeover and was donated to the Bentonville Public Library by 20th Century Fox and Walmart. Now, Rexy's last day in Bentonville is Thursday. Library officials say he'll still pose for pictures until then. And while Rexy is leaving the area, a former Razorback is coming back. It was announced earlier today that former Arkansas women's basketball standout Christy Smith will be joining the Arkansas women's basketball coaching staff. She will be the top assistant for the recently hired new head coach, Jimmy Dykes. Christy Smith was an All-American while at Arkansas, playing point guard, helped Arkansas get to the Final Four, and she played in the WNBA. She has also been an assistant coach at Purdue, helping the Boilermakers reach the NCAA tournament three consecutive years.
Hi, it's KUAF station manager Rick Stockdale with a big thank you to everyone who pledged or made a donation to KUAF during our spring on-air fundraiser. Listener support is the largest and most reliable source of funding for public radio. Thanks again to everyone who helped make our spring on-air fundraiser a success.
This is Ozarks at Large. The collection of rituals, ceremonies, and practices many Westerners refer to as voodoo is present on six continents. The popular images of zombies and magic became the norm for many of us. This is Ozarks at Large. The collection of rituals, ceremonies, and practices many Westerners refer to as voodoo is present on six continents. The popular images of zombies and black magic became the norm more than 80 years ago with the release of the horror movie White Zombie.
Why did you drive like that, you fool? We might have been killed.
Worse than that, monsieur. We might have been caught.
Caught? By whom? Those men you spoke to?
They are not men, monsieur. They are dead bodies.
Dead?
Yes, monsieur. Zombies. The living dead. Corpses taken from their graves. Or made to work in sugar mills and fields at night.
The 1932 film was a commercial success. Tim Landry, an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at North Dakota State, says the images from the movie survive, but don't give an accurate picture of the global practice of voodoo. Landry was on the University of Arkansas campus Friday to deliver a lecture as a guest of the U of A's Religious Studies program. During his visit, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about his research. I began our conversation by asking him why he began studying the complex and, to many of us, still mysterious realm of voodoo.
You know, I'm from originally from a New Orleanian family, and my dad was an aerospace engineer, so we lived in Houston, but moved back and forth between New Orleans and Houston quite a bit. And being from a New Orleanian family, you see voodoo pretty much all around the landscape, and it really got me very interested in the religion from a very early age. And from there, I just started developing an interest in religion in general. And when I was in graduate school, decided to do my first research project in Haiti. And from there, I looked at spirit possession work and studied the religion, and because it strongly influences New Orleans and strongly influences the religious systems in New Orleans, the African diasporic religious systems there. And when I was in graduate school, I couldn't go back to Haiti because there was a lot of political problems happening at the time. And so I ended up deciding to continue the research in Africa. And that's where it led me to West Africa to do the work that I'm doing now.
I lived briefly in New Orleans and go back there often. So I do know that there's this voodoo culture. But for someone who's an outsider, it seems as a sort of kitschy sort of voodoo tour. You know, I don't think for many of us we see it and think religion necessarily. We think a movie plot or something.
Well, you know, this happened in the 1960s, really, where voodoo was starting to be marketed in New Orleans for tourism. And people were starting to really attract people from different religious systems. There's several different religions that people group under the voodoo rubric, although it's a little bit problematic. The voodoo religion is the one that really comes from Benin, West Africa, moved to Haiti, and then, you know, New Orleans in some ways is kind of a northern annex to Haiti, where it's had this long connection with Haiti historically. So you have a lot of people who are practicing voodoo in New Orleans vis-a-vis Haiti. But then during the 60s, when you had this tourism revival happening, they were starting to blend a lot of different religious systems that were from the area, that were thriving in the area, like Cuban Santeria, Obeah, all these different religious systems that were being grouped together as voodoo. And that's really what you see today. So it's kind of problematic when you're looking at New Orleans today, because there's these multiple layers. I mean, there's almost, we can say there's a front stage and a backstage in some ways to the religion that's practices, the stuff that we see in the French Quarter and the stuff that you see in the shops and all these things. There's definitely a very strong tourist market for the religion. But there is also people there who practice the religion, and there's multiple layers of even that. You know, there are people who say that they've had it in their family for many, many, many years, and they're continuing to practice the religion. And then you have these newer imports like Haitians and Cubans who are kind of subsuming themselves under this broader category, which makes New Orleans a very complicated space to look at it. But yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you to answer an impossible question, but because so many of us, what we think of voodoo is comes from films, and it's zombies and these larger-than-life characters. How would you sum up, again, realizing that I'm asking you to do something that's very hard to do, but what should we know about the religion?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, you're right that what we know about the religion really comes from the 1920s and 1930s through film. Thinking of the White Zombie in 1932.
Lugosi.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
really a great film.
That was really the film that brought the genre, the zombie genre and the voodoo genre to film. And in some ways that film was influenced by early literature, 1929, Magic Island. So you're right that I think what we think of voodoo in our society is film, is related to film and literature and stuff. What I could say about the religion in general is, first of all, the problem calling it a religion is very problematic, because this is a Western category. You know, we think of what religions are, that we practice religions, and that we have, that religions have these boundaries. And in reality, people who practice voodoo in Haiti, for example, are very, very devout Catholics. Most of them go to church or go to mass multiple times a week. They would make most devout American Catholics look very lax. I mean, they're very, very devout. So there's these boundaries that people have with I practice this religion or that religion get broken down in voodoo, and it's really problematic to think of them as a category. But if we were to generalize, and we were to essentialize just for the average person who wanted to know what these religious systems are, basically it's a religion that honors these kind of natural forces in the world around them that they call, if we're talking about the Haitian variant, they call Loa. If we're talking about the West African variant, they call Vodun. The word Vodun itself just means spirit, divinity, or God. And this is where it becomes complicated, because people from all over the world, no matter what religion they practice, people who are born in this Vodun worldview in West Africa would call any god or any spirit or any divinity Vodun. As a matter of fact, when I was in West Africa, somebody described Jesus as a Vodun and said, oh, that's that person's Vodun, or that person's spirit. So it becomes complicated, because each spirit, and there are hundreds and if not thousands, have their own set of rituals, their own set of beliefs, their own set of customs, their own set of rules and regulations. So really, Vodun is a large umbrella term for many smaller types of religions that fall underneath that within West Africa. In Haiti, it's a bit more organized. They are monotheistic. They believe in one all-powerful deity, the creator deity of the universe. And then there are multiple divinities that fall underneath them, which is why Catholicism maps very neatly on top of these religions. Thinking of the creator God and of saints and angels and all these kinds of things mapped very cleanly on top of these African systems. So,
when you went to Africa, the first time, I mean, what is that like? Because, you know, there's always the danger of, here I am from the United States, and I want to study something that is inherent here, and how do you come off as not...
Yeah, it's complicated. You know, because I came to West Africa having worked in Haiti, I think that helped. We were having interesting conversations about the similarities between voodoo in West Africa and voodoo in Haiti, and this is really a conversation that I could actively have with them. I remember one day sitting on my porch writing, and I had this voodoo song in my head that I was kind of singing, and somebody was walking by and heard me singing, it was a Haitian song, and they stopped me and asked me to sing it again, and they said, oh, you know, that's fun. I can understand the language. And Haitians would have categorized it as what they call langage. It's this ritual language that they don't really understand, that they say that they've forgotten through time, that it's basically what Haitians call langage is this remnant of Fon language that's being spoken in Haiti. So there's very strong connections between these two religions. So we're looking at a song that Haitians sing actively, and they don't understand it linguistically, but there I was in Benin singing the song, and they could translate it almost word for word of what the song was saying. So the connections are very strong. So those kinds of moments, I think, opened up a lot of doors for me in West Africa, where people saw that I was deeply connected with the religious system in Haiti, as I wasn't, you know, and they saw these connections, and I think it opened up some doors. Yeah, it's complicated. You know, because I came to West Africa having worked in Haiti, I think that helped. We were having interesting conversations about the similarities between Vodou in West Africa and Vodou in Haiti, and this was really a conversation that I could actively have with them. I remember one day sitting on my porch writing, and I had this Vodou song in my head that I was kind of singing, and somebody was walking by and heard me singing, it was a Haitian song, and they stopped me and asked me to sing it again, and they said, "Oh, you know, that's Fon. I can understand the language." And Haitians would have categorized it as what they call langage. It's this ritual language that they don't really understand, that they say that they've forgotten through time, that it's basically what Haitians call langage is this remnant of Fon language that's being spoken in Haiti. So there's very strong connections between these two religions. So we're looking at a song that Haitians sing actively, and they don't understand it linguistically. But there I was in Benin singing the song, and they could translate it almost word for word of what the song was saying. So the connections are very strong. So those kinds of moments, I think, opened up a lot of doors for me in West Africa, where people saw that I was deeply connected with the religious system in Haiti, as I wasn't, you know, and they saw these connections, and I think it opened up some doors.
You look at the history of religions on this planet, and there is often a sense of spreading the word, proselytizing. Does that exist in this world?
I don't think it exists structurally. I don't think there's certainly not a tenet of the religion that you must be Vodou. Because remember, if you're Catholic or if you're Muslim or if you're Buddhist, Vodou people see you as doing your version of Vodou, right?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's not about conversion in that sense. It's not a preoccupation of Vodou people. But certainly since the 1980s into the 1990s and even into today, there has been a heightened preoccupation with what I'm terming spiritual tourism, although I understand that term is somewhat problematic, where Westerners, mostly Americans or people from Europe, are going to Haiti and West Africa to be initiated in these religions. So while there's no formal processes for conversion, I think there's an economic, perhaps, component to why certain people are allowing an increasing number of people who are not Haitian, who are not West African, to participate in these religious systems. And it's had a ripple effect. I think that the religion is certainly globalizing. Just a couple weeks ago, I saw some information about a Vodou ceremony happening in Japan. I mean, it's certainly happening all over the world at this point. And spiritual tourism is kind of the current trend that it's in right now, where people are actively seeking conversion into these religions. The language of conversion is always the language of the Westerner kind of involving and not the language of the Haitian or the West African. But certainly there's a trend. I'm not sure that it's one that necessarily is being actively supported or actively sought out by Haitians and West Africans for religious reasons, maybe for economic reasons or social capital or cultural capital, but it's certainly not part of the religious doctrine, or it's not really a dogmatic religion. You know, so.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Wonderful. You're very welcome.
Tim Landry, a visiting professor in the North Dakota State Department of Sociology and Anthropology, was on the University of Arkansas campus Friday to deliver a talk about Vodou as a guest of the university's Religious Studies program. This is Ozarks at Large. It is Monday, April 14th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. With me, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Well, you know, I've been doing these themed days.
Yes.
So this is miscellaneous Monday.
Okay.
That's or Manic Monday, okay, or Magic Monday, or there is a sandwiched in program at noon on Wednesday at the Shiloh Museum.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the Shiloh Museum week.
Yeah. Mm.
It is a program by Brenda Patterson from the Madison County Health Coalition on the history of tobacco advertising.
Oh, should be interesting.
Yeah.
Back when in World War II, when more doctors, they would say more doctors smoked Camel or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Than, you know, it was.
Oh, my mother smoked for years, like one cigarette or two a day, but her doctor actually prescribed it to help her allergies.
Okay.
So
there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
And if you go at noon Wednesday, you not only get to hear the program, they have cookies.
Oh, well, even better.
And there's a program called A Maritime Perspective at 7 o'clock Thursday with Lindsay Scott. It's a program shared between the Arkoma chapter of the Arkansas Archaeological Society and the Oklahoma Anthropological Society. And it happens in room 211 of the Math and Science Building at UAFS.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating topics always with them.
Arkansas River, I'm sure, is the center of this. Okay.
And it's free.
Very good. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Dream Girl, take five.
Dream Girl, Dream Girl, I love the song. Dream Girl, I love the song. Why, it's you, you dear that I adore.
The story of Jesse Belvin is shrouded in some uncertainty, from his alleged hometown of Texarkana to his 1960 car crash death in southwest Arkansas. More certain is Belvin's status as a prime mover behind 1950s West Coast doo-wop. That music influenced everyone from the Beach Boys to Frank Zappa to pioneers in reggae music and beyond. But Belvin was said to be cavalier about songwriting credit and would sell his songs for immediate cash to others, who would then reap the long-term publishing. This makes tracking Belvin's influence and career still more difficult. Whatever events may have conspired to make him obscure, it's ironic for Jesse Belvin to be so forgotten today. He was once thought to be the next big crossover crooner in the mold of Nat King Cole. Late 1950s RCA Records promo materials even called him the Black Elvis.
Lord knows I felt like a king. Other girls didn't mean a doggone thing.
Jesse Lorenzo Belvin was born in 1933 in Texarkana. Or maybe it was San Antonio, Texas in 1932. His first mark in popular music was in 1950 as a part of the vocal quartet Three Dots and a Dash, backing R&B saxophonist Big J. McNeely on a single. But Belvin soon came into his own. Like so many vocalists in doo-wop and rhythm and blues, Jesse Belvin got his start singing in church. And like another contemporary, Sam Cooke, Belvin was the whole package. A handsome singer, writer, and arranger, so talented and prolific, he lifted other artists with his creativity. Some of Belvin's best-known songs are by others, like Earth Angel by the Penguins. His first hit, Dream Girl, heard earlier, was listed as by Jesse and Marvin. Even his biggest solo hits, like Goodnight My Love and Guess Who, heard here as interpreted by Dean Martin, have been adopted by many others. Belvin sang with many a vocal group on small West Coast record labels like Cash and Hollywood, often under a pseudonym since he was under contract. In fact, Belvin recorded so prolifically for so many different groups, his full impact on doo-wop and beyond can likely never be calculated. You can hear Belvin singing with the Sheiks, the Californians, the Shields, the Clicks, and countless others. Sometimes the songs went nowhere. Sometimes, like You Cheated by the Shields, they went top 10. The bulk of Jesse Belvin's work done under his own name was for two larger independent labels in Los Angeles, California, Specialty and Modern. In 1956, Jesse Belvin again hit pay dirt when the ballad Goodnight My Love became an R&B hit. The song was adopted as closing theme music of programs by both Alan Freed and Dick Clark. By the late 1950s, Belden's talent was recognized enough that he signed with major label RCA Victor. Elvis Presley had recently signed there also, and the company's PR team began a campaign branding Belvin as the Black Elvis. Belvin's sound had matured through the 1950s. Already conversant in doo-wop and R&B, Belvin began trending towards standards, ballads, and pop during this time, and the move paid off. Soon, Belvin had his first top 40 hit, 1959's Guess Who. With a major label solo deal, his first solo top 10 hit, and a big tour set for 1960, the new decade must have seemed full of promise for Jesse Belvin. But instead, Belvin's life ended on a highway in Hempstead County near Hope on February 6th, 1960. Decades later, his music is as big as ever, even as Jesse Belvin's influence continues to reveal itself. Here in its entirety is Jesse Belvin with his hit, Good Night, My Love, from 1956.
And dreams and sleep tight, my love. May tomorrow be sunny and bright and bring you closer to me.
Jesse Belvin, said to be of Texarkana, who died in Hempstead County in 1960 with his hit Good Night, My Love, from 1956. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
And just ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, the latest edition to the trail system in northwest Arkansas. Timothy Dennis went to a ribbon cutting this weekend. He'll have that story in just a moment. KUAF Night with the Naturals will be April 24th at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. KUAF ticket holders will be seated together, and an on-field photo will be taken of our group. A portion of ticket sales will benefit KUAF. KUAF tickets are only available at 927 4063, or you can click the banner at KUAF.com to email in an order.
On the next Fresh Air, how antibiotics, cesarean sections, and sanitizers are destroying the balance of the human microbiome, the massive collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. We talk with Dr. Martin Blaser, who speculates that changes in the microbiome may be contributing to obesity, asthma, and allergies. Join us.
Listen to Fresh Air this evening beginning at 6 on 91.3 FM.
The web of trails connecting communities throughout Northwest Arkansas grew again this weekend. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports the latest addition will allow people to see a part of the area most have never seen.
And with that, the new Clear Creek Trail was officially opened. The trail is a 2.25-mile long section that mostly lies in Johnson and ties into Fayetteville's trail system. It is also a part of the Razorback Greenway Trail, the 36-mile trail system that will stretch between Lake Bella Vista in Bentonville and Walker Park in Fayetteville. The first trail in Johnson, Mayor Buddy Curry says the completion of Clear Creek Trail is eye-opening to him.
We've seen this hard work going on for quite a few years down here from a lot of volunteers, and the city of Johnson's officially has never been involved in this. It's all been a committee, but we've been backing them up. And now that it's opened, now it's time for the city to step forward.
Dan Cross is one of the members of Johnson Clear Creek Trails, the nonprofit group that led the push for trails within the city.
You know, right now, if you're cynical, all we've done is connect Fayetteville to Fayetteville, which may not look good on a resume, but we've given everybody access to Clear Creek. Before this project, the only ones that have seen this part of the creek were the landowners. Five people, maybe. We've opened up this beautiful scenery, this green space.
But Mayor Curry says that opening Clear Creek Trail is just the beginning of trails in Johnson, as plans are already underway for the construction of a trailhead on 5 acres of donated land.
That was one of the questions I had for them. I said, well, we're going to have a nice trail, but how do we get on it? We have no place in our town to access this. We need to find something. And one of the members, Dan Cross, I mentioned to him something, and he said, well, I'll go talk to Walt. And Walt graciously gave us a beautiful spot for a trailhead.
Walt is Walt Robinson, a Johnson landowner who says the decision to donate the land was a simple one.
The trailhead is actually the best usage for that particular piece of land. It's very low, and of course, this community has been wonderful to me, and so I'm getting older, and this is a chance for me to give back and do something for all of Northwest Arkansas, which my wife and I are proud to do.
If there's one group that looks to have the trails connect communities, it's the Walton Family Foundation. The charitable foundation has provided matching funds for a $15 million federal transportation grant to build the Razorback Greenway. Rod Brothers, the director of the foundation's home region focus area, says that a study conducted by the foundation shows that there is overwhelming support for trails in Northwest Arkansas.
We had a quality of life survey completed in August of 2012, and it was really interesting. The trails were acknowledged by more than 80% of the people and had very high degrees of usage. Really interesting that in Springdale, people that identified themselves as Springdale residents were one of the heaviest users of trails, and there really are very few trails in the city of Springdale. So trails were something that predominantly in the survey people recognized as leading to quality of life and using trails.
Meanwhile, another regional organization that has a vested interest in developing the trail system did an analysis of its own. John McClarty is a senior planner with the Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission.
We did a geographical analysis just yesterday based on the 2010 census, and within 1/2 mile of this trail, the 36 mile corridor, 76,000 people live within 1/2 mile of this trail. And 80,000 people are employed within 1/2 mile of this trail. So that means that gives this trail a tremendous potential to be used not just for recreation, and there's Nothing wrong with recreation. That's great. But it can also be used for daily alternative transportation methods.
And with the new Clear Creek Trail opened, it's likely to bring more daily usage from Fayetteville residents, as it does create a connection between points in Fayetteville. But Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan says that this trail isn't just a boon for his city.
This is a trail of regional connectivity, if you will, where, you know, it's not just about one city or the other city, but it's all the cities and it's all the people of the region working together to make this happen. You know, I used a quote today from Eleanor Roosevelt, the future belongs to those that dream and believe in the beauty of their dreams. This was a dream 5 years ago, but now it's a reality. And it took all of us working together and the whole region to make this a complete, if you will, taking the dream and bringing it into reality. And today you see that reality of this regional trail.
Matt Mihalovich, Fayetteville's City Trails Coordinator, told the assembled crowd at Saturday's ribbon-cutting ceremony that while it brings new connections to the trail system, cyclists can access those connections without worrying about interference from motorists.
Some of the things I really like about this trail is it actually doesn't cross any streets. We were able to go under bridges with all of our crossings. Direct connection from Skull Creek Trail to Lake Fayetteville Trail, which is 5.5 miles of loop there and soon to be continued on north. So just really exciting to have this trail.
Although the opening of Clear Creek Trail and the opening of Fayetteville's Frisco Trail Extension, which was also celebrated Saturday, signifies the ever-nearing overall completion of the Razorback Greenway, the city of Johnson has its eyes on extending trails within its own borders. Mayor Buddy Curry says that while more trail connections are already being planned, like a trail leading to Willow Creek Women's Hospital that will eventually lead to Arvest Ballpark, there is another concern that is equally as pressing as adding more miles of trail.
Number one, we got to figure out how to maintain this trail. I've had people ask me, well, what's your plan? I said, I don't know yet. We've never owned a trail. So we're going to play it by ear. We're going to monitor it. And we're going to make a plan as we go to see what we need to do. But we know we have to keep this looking beautiful through here because this is a fantastic trail.
With a bustling creek, fallow fields, and the buds of spring sprouting everywhere, Clear Creek Trail really is a nice respite from the hustle of the area's many highways. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is KUAF Membership Director Lee Wood saying thank you so much to the hundreds of listeners who called in or went online and made a contribution during our Spring On Air fundraiser. Thanks to you, KUAF can continue to bring you the great programming that you've come to enjoy. Thank you so much.
KUAF is proud to co-sponsor the 2014 Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. The 5 and 10K race plus 1 mile family walk will take place April 26th at the Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. A pre-race pasta party will be held on Friday, April 25th. Registration, pasta tickets, and more information available at komenozark.org or by calling 750-PINK. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Berryville. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda joins me tomorrow at noon for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll end today's show with a fond farewell to Jesse Winchester, Louisiana-born singer-songwriter who died Friday of cancer. Many were lucky enough to see him on the Odd Stage in Eureka Springs back in October 2004. Have a good Monday. Stay warm tonight.
Out the brand new Tennessee walls. You're literally waltzing on air. Up the brand new Tennessee walls. There's no telling who will be there.